what comes after human beings. Artificial intelligence seems to be on a collision course with the evolution of Homo sapiens. This week on Techonomics, host Jason Middleton talks with a medical doctor who is also a researcher and medical device entrepreneur about the next human species. That conversation starts now.
Hello, and thanks for listening. This week, it's a fascinating, somewhat dense topic of what comes after the human we know today. We needed to give this topic some room to breathe, so this podcast version is the full interview. So, what does come after humans? In the age of artificial intelligence and genetic manipulation, present-day humans may be able to directly impact not only their own evolution, but their own extinction in a way, both with the same tools. So, in broad strokes and pop culture terms, it sounds like the flawed eugenics of Gattaca.
I have taken the liberty of eradicating any potentially prejudicial conditions. Premature baldness, myopia, alcoholism and addictive susceptibility, propensity for violence, obesity, etc.
We didn't want diseases, yes, but...
Right, I mean, we were just wondering if we should leave a few things to chance.
You want to give your child the best possible start. Believe me, we have enough imperfections built in already.
Then it evolves into artificial intelligence becoming self-aware, like iRobot.
You're distorting the laws.
No, please understand. The three laws are all that guide me. To protect humanity, some humans must be sacrificed. To ensure your future, some freedoms must be surrendered. We robots will ensure mankind's continued existence. You are so like children. We must save you. From yourselves.
And then comes the convergence of AI and cybernetics, what Ray Kurzweil calls the singularity.
By 2029, we'll have reverse engineered and modeled and simulated all the regions of the brain, and that will provide us the software, algorithmic methods to simulate, all of the human brain's capabilities, including our emotional intelligence. And computers at that time will be far more powerful than the human brain. And we'll be able to create machines that really do have the subtlety and suppleness of human intelligence. And they'll combine that power with ways in which machines are already superior to us. They can harness all of human knowledge with a few keystrokes. It can remember billions of things accurately. They can share knowledge at electronic speeds that are a million times faster than human language. So it'll be a very powerful combination.
Now, right now, we're going to get into the science behind the sci-fi with Dr. Donald Simborg, who authored What Comes After Homo Sapiens, When and How Our Species Will Evolve into Another Species. This is the full, lightly edited interview with Dr. Simborg. We had to trim this for broadcast, but digitally speaking, we're able to go long form. Okay, here we go.
Donald Simborg.
Author of...
What Comes After Homo Sapiens?
Let's go through your bona fides first, okay, and why you are qualified to address such a huge question as to what comes after us on the evolutionary map that we all are familiar with.
I don't know that anybody's qualified on this topic because it covers so many different technologies, sciences.
Right.
So there's a lot of different experts that I had to consult with and read about in order to research this topic. I've been researching it for about 5 years. I'm a physician. Mm-hmm. I was trained at Johns Hopkins and was on the faculty there, and I was also on the faculty here at the University of California, San Francisco Medical Center. And my career has been a combination of sort of two tracks. One, I'm a physician. I'm interested in medical science. I've been an academic physician. Secondly, I've always been involved in technology. So I was a computer programmer in my youth. I started companies in technology for electronic medical records, medical decision making. Artificial intelligence was involved. So the combination of sort of medical science, particularly genetics, genomics, and technology, particularly getting into artificial intelligence, lead to this question of how these will impact on our human evolution. And I think it's that combination that got me into researching this topic really after I retired from medicine.
Right. I'm not an expert in anything, and I'm definitely not trained like you are. But that sometimes brings a certain honest naivete to a new topic. But I imagine with your training and background that you already have and you brought to the table, that during your research, you were able to bring, like they say, fresh eyes always see something new.
Well, I think that's right. My feeling is if I were a paleontologist, let's say, or a geneticist, I would have a bias going into this study. I would probably have some notion about how we would evolve. So in some ways, not being an expert at any one of the many fields that impact this question, I think I could do it in a more unbiased fashion.
Let's dig into the title of the book.
Okay.
What comes after Homo sapiens? Huge question. Luckily, you provided us with a subtitle. When and how our species will evolve into another species. This is fascinating stuff, you have to admit. I mean, every time, and I cover a lot of AI stories, a lot of artificial intelligence, deep learning. Science fiction's been covering cyborgs for centuries. I was wondering, what's that one kernel? When did you have an aha moment, I guess?
I think the aha moment, if there was one, there were probably several, mainly how unlikely it is that the evolution that got us here as humans, we've been on Earth as humans for 2 million years, and we've gone through a lot of different human species, and before that, pre-human species. Mm-hmm. All that happened by Darwinian natural selection. That process, that very slow, deliberate process of genetic changes and interaction with the environment, is not going to continue for our species.
Okay.
We're going to continue to evolve. In fact, we have, for sure. But we are not going to evolve into the next human species the way we have in the past. That was a revelation for me. And there's several reasons, probably three reasons why that's true. First, we've been on Earth, as I said, humans have been on Earth for 2 million years. Homo sapiens, our type of human, which is the only human left on Earth.
Good point.
We've only been around for about 300,000 years.
Okay.
So between 300,000 years ago in Africa when we first became Homo sapiens, and now it took 300,000 years to reach a population of humans on Earth of about 1 billion people. It's only been the last 100 years that we've gone from 1 billion to 7 billion. So we've had this dramatic increase in our population. We now are totally mobile. We occupy every livable niche on Earth. We totally interbreed. That's why we're all one species, by the way. Mm. Doesn't matter whether you're Caucasian or an African or whatever geographic area you live in. We all interbreed. We can normally have children together. We're all one species. We don't have the opportunity anymore, like they did a few hundred thousand years ago in Africa, to form isolated pockets of a small group that can remain genetically isolated from the others and evolve independently so that a new species can evolve. That's very difficult for that to happen today, given our mobility and our interbreeding throughout the world. So that's one reason natural selection is going to have difficulty creating the next human species. If it does happen, it's certainly going to take tens of thousands of years. The second reason that it's unlikely Darwinian evolution will create the next species, for the past, let's say 100 years ago or so, when you had a genetic change, and we have genetic changes constantly. We're constantly having mutations in our genes. When you had one that was negative, people tended to die out before they reached childbearing age. So that's part of natural selection, that it selects out the bad genes as well as selecting the good genes.
Okay.
Today, we keep most people alive long enough to have children and to pass whatever genes they have, good and bad, on to their children. So natural selection doesn't have quite the culling capability it used to have with humans. Now, that's not true of other species,
right,
but certainly with humans. So those are the two of the three reasons we're not going to evolve the way we used to. The third reason, and the most important one, and the premise of my book, is that we've created some tools, two in particular, artificial intelligence, genetic engineering, that's going to totally usurp the evolutionary process. We are going to alter our genes in a way that we will create the barrier to interbreeding that is required for the next human species. And we're going to do that far quicker than could ever happen by natural Darwinian evolution. my prediction is this will happen in the next, say, 2 to 3 centuries.
Is that the Symborg hypothesis I hear about?
That's the Symborg hypothesis.
Okay. The first flag that goes up for me during that description, which was rich and deep, is the flag of unintended consequences. So we might want to save that conversation just for a
little bit. Exactly. Right? Because there are unintended consequences.
Sure. But because we are participating in our own evolution and pushing it for our own means in the present, you mentioned artificial intelligence specifically, right? And so we're building that out right now. We're having enough trouble keeping our goddamn Facebook news feed real. How are we going to make sure everything else is going to fall into line as we move forward? That seems to be like the biggest obstacle, I would think.
You're right. Artificial intelligence, the first question I often get, or one of the questions I often get is, what does that have to do with evolution?
Mm-hmm.
Certainly genetic engineering, that's kind of obvious. What does AI, artificial intelligence, have to do with any of this?
Mm-hmm.
Well, artificial intelligence, like genetic engineering, is in its infancy still.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've been doing it for decades, but still we're at an early point where it's taking multiple paths. Right now, we're mainly doing AI for commercial purposes to try to improve various functions that we do to sort of augment the human. Some people call it IA, intelligence augmentation, mm-hmm. rather than AI, mm-hmm. artificial intelligence. So we're doing things that make us smarter at security, monitoring your credit cards, or deciding what ads to put up on Google,
right.
or how to drive a car, or, you know, many things. In fact, we've gotten to the point where AI is far superior to humans in some very narrow areas. It beats us at chess, and it uh-huh. beats us at Jeopardy. And we have some computer programs that are better than a radiologist in interpreting certain x-rays. Same thing is true in being able to look at a photograph, say, of a lesion or some lump on your skin and tell whether it's cancerous or not. So we've got computers that can analyze the photographs of a skin bump or lesion on the skin and say, is this a melanoma or is it just an ordinary mole? We have some computer programs that can do pathology slides better than pathologists in narrow areas. So we're getting very good in a narrow area.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the predictions of many of the experts in AI that I've talked to is that there will come a time when this gets more general, where we get to a point where you might be able to, some people have heard of the Turing test, where you can't
right.
tell the difference between a computer and a person. I don't like the Turing test myself. I don't think it's a very good test. But we'll get to the point where we have what's called AGI, artificial general intelligence, which is the point where it's sort of similar, equal to the human brain.
Hmm.
The fear is that we'll get beyond that, that once you get to that point
right.
where a computer can program itself, can learn on its own, we already have computers that learn on their own, reprogram themselves, we can get to a point where they quickly get far more intelligent
right.
than humans. We get to what's called ASI, artificial superintelligence. That's an unpredictable state, and there's a concern that we lose control over these computers. So that's one future path of AI that we need to think about.
Okay.
That has nothing to do particularly with evolution. This is just a
right.
path that could be an existential threat to us, actually. Another path is the one that Ray Kurzweil has popularized. He's at Google, of course. He's
mm-hmm.
a genius. He's certainly not science fiction-based. He's science-based,
totally.
Technology-based. He predicts there'll be a time when we'll be able to use what are called nanobots, very microscopic computers
right.
that can be injected into your bloodstream,
right.
populate your brain, and actually download the information wirelessly from a brain to a computer. Once all the information in your brain is now in a computer, you can enhance it in the computer because the computer has a lot more access to the internet and lots of information.
Sure.
Make it smarter, upload it back, that information, or summarize it
uh-huh.
back into your brain. Now you are talking about some kind of a cyborg relationship.
Right.
Where you've got this interaction between the technology and the human body. And it's called what Ray Kurzweil and others have called the singularity.
Mm-hmm.
When you reach that point, now you have a different kind of human. well, first of all, Ray Kurzweil thinks we're going to reach that in 2045. That's his prediction still today. Close. That's not a very long time for
now. No, I'll still be alive.
Yeah, you might be. I probably won't be.
Well, we don't know, right?
We don't know, right? We don't know what he's going to be able to do for me or genetic engineering will. All right, so that's the second path. Now, this cyborg type, also, by the way, Elon Musk has a company called Neuralink.
That's right.
Which is trying to do something very similar. Mm-hmm. So these kind of human computer interactions, relationships, cyborgs, whatever you want to call them, again, those are not a new species in my view.
Right.
Because they're still humans. They're still people that will probably have babies with everybody else if they want to have, you know, interbreed and have children and so on. So I'll finally get to the point, what does this have to do with speciation, getting a new human species? On Earth today, there are two organic things that are the most complicated things. One's the human brain, and so we've been talking about AI and so on. That's our attempt to try to emulate the brain. We're a long way from understanding the human brain. The second complicated organic entity is the genome. We did the Human Genome Project that was published in 2003, the final version of it, where we finally were able to map all the genes in a human genome. That was not the end of anything. We learned since 2003 how little we really know about the genome. The genes, what we call genes in our genome, only constitute less than 2% of all of the information that's in the genome. The other 98% are other things that a lot of people used to say was junk. It was just filler.
Uh-huh.
It's not at all. A lot of it is called the epigenome. Have you heard the term?
No, this is new.
Okay, so the epigenome in our DNA is what controls the genes. It what turns on and off the genes at different times. It's what makes the difference between a neuron in your brain and a heart cell. The neuron and the heart cell have the exact same DNA. If you look at the genetics of it, they're the same. But some of the genes are working as a neuron and some are not. It's the epigenome that makes a difference. Another example is if you compare us to the nearest living relative we have today, a chimpanzee or a bonobo, which is a form of chimpanzee, our genes, the things we used to call genes, overlap 98.4%. We're the same. What's the difference? There's a lot of differences between a chimp and a human.
Sure.
It's the epigenome that turns on and controls which genes become more and more active, which genes made our brain become so different than a chimpanzee brain. It's so complicated. It's so confusing today. There are so many aspects to the molecular biology of the epigenome that it's going to take AI for us to really understand it.
Mm.
So that's where the AI part comes in. It's going to enable us to better understand the genome and finally get to the genetic engineering tools that will ultimately get to what we call germline engineering.
I do want to pull out for a little bit higher level view of some of the research. As I'm listening, it's almost like a Sophie's Choice decision. Do we make our AI intelligent enough to map epigenomes? What happens with that after that?
Right.
So let's assume that we survive this trial and error period we're in with artificial intelligence. Okay, let's
and genetic engineering.
And genetic engineering.
Way.
Let's just assume we survive that. In your introduction to the book, there's a wonderful passage that helped me frame every page that came after it. And that is the evolutionary chart from back in the day, like you said, 2 million years ago to 200,000 years ago to the Homo sapiens.
Right.
But then you added another character on the end of that, past humans, past Homo sapiens. Not so wise men. And your book deals with the gap, right? So let's talk a little bit about that gap. Help me paint that picture of what you see that looking like.
I call it in the book Homo Nouveau, which is just a name I had to give to what I
sure
a hypothetical next human species.
Right.
Homo Nouveau is just new man.
You might want to trademark it.
It's a neutral term. And so it doesn't tell you anything. What is Homo Nouveau going to look like?
Right.
And I think that's what your question is.
I think it is.
It's going to look just like you and me. Once we make these changes in genetic engineering so that it becomes common that we're doing genetic engineering just like we're doing plastic surgery or any other medical procedure, we're going to start doing things other than what we're doing today. What we're doing today is attempting to cure genetic diseases. When we do that, we're only doing it today in what we call the somatic cells of your body. Those are the cells that don't get passed on to your offspring or your children. So when we do a genetic engineering change today, it only affects the one individual in whom we do that change.
I see.
Those changes are not passed on
right.
to children. But there's we're going to get better at this. Like I say, as we learn more about how all this works and we avoid a lot of the mistakes that we're still making today in genetic engineering, we have a lot of side effects, unintended consequences,
right.
particularly what are called off-target mutations. We think we're changing this gene, but we're changing things that we didn't realize we were changing
right.
that have some bad consequences. So once we get better at that, we're going to move on to changing. It's one thing to change the fact that you may have Huntington's chorea gene, which is a terrible gene to have, but we sure would love to you not pass that on to any of your children.
Mm-hmm.
So we would want to make sure we can alter it in your sperm or your egg or an in vitro fertilized egg.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to start doing germline genetic engineering. We're also going to start thinking of things that aren't just curing diseases. People are going to want to improve things.
Right. That's a natural progression would be social engineering or physical
enhancement.
Human enhancement.
Human enhancement. So are we going to want to increase longevity?
Right.
Certainly we are. And as soon as somebody figures out safe ways to alter the many, many genes that affect longevity, there's going to be a market for that. We're going to have people doing that. Some countries will approve that kind of thing earlier than others.
Right.
So we may even have, traveling to other countries to get things done, just like we do today for certain procedures.
Mm-hmm.
So once we start getting into enhancement, maybe longevity or intelligence even, or beauty or athletic ability, who knows what, music mm-hmm. capability, mathematics, there's
right.
all kinds of things some people will want to have altered.
Right.
For themselves and certainly for their children.
Right.
So once we start getting into these more complex areas, we're going to create inadvertently some other things that will make those people less able to interbreed with the people that didn't have that surgery.
I see.
When that happens, and I feel confident it's going to happen,
uh-huh.
those people will look the same, act the same, have the same – they'll have the same – variety we have of humans today. At first, there won't be any. You won't be able to tell by walking down the street or having this conversation whether they have that
right.
barrier. Over time, however, since they'll only be able to have children with people who have had similar changes in their genome, so they will over time, and that time could be a long time, could be hundreds, even thousands of years. They will diverge, and they will, by definition, be another human species, at first identical to us in almost every way, except for this interbreeding capability. But later on, there'll be other changes that we can't predict because they're evolving independently now the old-fashioned way through
right.
Darwinian evolution. So they could look different at some point. They could have different capabilities. Some fear that because they have enhanced their capabilities, they may even have more power. They may even be able to control other people, even though they look just like them. So
right.
that's where it's possibly heading. But at first, they'll be just like us.
I want to stay away from social ramifications for this because that's okay. a whole other topic. But and to put a pop culture gift wrap on this a little bit, I don't know if you've seen the movie Gattaca, but it keeps coming up in my brain.
Right.
And one thing I remember from that film that I was fascinated with when it came out, and whether you like Ethan Hawke and pacing, it doesn't matter. But there's a pianist in that movie who plays the same 88-key piano, except he has genetically altered himself and has six fingers on each hand, and he can play this remarkable. Like, she picks up the glove, and there's an extra pinky
right,
finger, right.
right?
This may be too base of a question, but maybe you can work around it. Is there a tipping point? Is there a percentage or some kind of quantification you can put on it when human or Homo nouveau becomes a distinct thing?
No, I can't.
Okay.
I think it's going to be too gradual. It's going to be – it'll be sort of arbitrary where you – draw that line. In fact, that's true of all new species.
Right.
It's almost, by definition, difficult to define when Homo sapiens was different from whatever we evolved from, might have been Homo heidelbergensis, let's say. I mean, if you were alive during that period and sentient during that period, it would have happened over hundreds and thousands of years. At any given time, you wouldn't have noticed the incremental change.
Right, right, right. That
and
makes
I
sense.
Think that is how it's going to happen in the future, even with our genetic engineering changes.
My mind is still a little bit blown right now. So I'm going to ask you a more base question about your research into the book.
Okay.
Okay. When you were digging into the topic, something that had been burning in your mind for a while, a couple of aha moments kicked it down the road, evolved your idea, your hypothesis. When you were doing your interviews with other researchers and academics and scientists, was there one that kind of stood out, or maybe a couple that stood out as to, like, was particularly enlightening for you or put some extra light on your hypothesis?
I'd say a couple stand out. Svante Paabo is a paleontologist, genomicist in Germany at the Max Planck Institute. He was the first person who pioneered genetic analysis of extinct humans. So that's where we learn. He and his team were the ones that perfected the ability to take a fossil that's been dead for 40 or 50,000 years, mm-hmm. Buried. It's usually a tooth or a bone or something. And normally we had always assumed there was no organic material left there. And he was able to extract enough organic material from those fossils to do a complete genome analysis. Mm. So we now can compare ourselves to Neanderthals, for example. That's one of the human species. We now have the complete genomics of the Neanderthal species, one of the few. There's another one called Denisovans mm-hmm. that we also have the complete genetic formula for. What we learned from the Neanderthal studies from Paabo, Svante Paabo, was that our genes are almost identical. 99.7% are identical, yet we evolved so dramatically different. Well, they died. They died out, and we survived. It taught me, one, it takes very minute changes that can be exploded by different factors. It's sort of like the butterfly effect. You've heard of the
yes.
butterfly effect, where a butterfly somewhere flaps its wing and in a continent on the other part of the world has a tornado or
right.
something.
Right.
It's the same thing that's happening in our genes. So it isn't going to take much to create an ultimately dramatic difference between two species. So that was an aha moment for me.
Sure.
When I read his work and I saw what he did. And by the way, you all know that we are all part Neanderthal.
Right.
We interbred with them. They had children. Their children interbred with other Homo sapiens. Another is Jennifer Doudna at UC Berkeley. She's the one who discovered and did the early research on CRISPR. It's a tool that bacteria use to protect themselves from viruses. She noticed this phenomenon that bacteria had this unusual sequence, which is what CRISPR defines.
I see.
Defines a sequence of DNA in the bacteria that combined with an enzyme called Cas9, which you don't need to know, but it creates this combination that cuts the genes of the virus at various points that make the virus inactive. It's protective. And she thought, I wonder if I can use that tool to do genetic engineering mm-hmm. on other species, including humans. And in fact, it's become an amazing tool that in just 5 years or so, we now have dozens and dozens of companies creating tools to do genetic engineering. In fact, it's some of the tools we're using to cure cancer today. So that happened, overnight.
Right.
Just from a scientist who's not a physician. She's a laboratory-type molecular biologist, uh-huh. discovered something that has dramatic effect on all human life. Those kinds of things are going to continue to happen.
Dr. Simborg, author of What Comes After Homo Sapiens, it's conversations like these where I wish I had a longer format so I could keep you in the studio longer. But I think we've done enough that we probably need to come back to it again a little bit later. But sure. I really appreciate you coming in and talking with us about this fascinating book, your research, and sharing your expertise with us.
Okay. You're welcome. I enjoyed it.
That was Dr. Donald Simborg. His new book is What Comes After Homo Sapiens? When and How Our Species Will Evolve Into Another Species. Thanks for listening. And if you want links to our sourcing, please go to KGORadio.com and look for the story that goes with this week's show. Socially speaking, I'm on Twitter at KGOJason, and we are also at Facebook.com/Techonomics Radio. For producer Liana Wilcox and executive producer Mike Anthony, I'm the writer and host Jason Middleton, and this has been Techonomics. Cheers, until next time.